The topic is related to graphene, index theorem, and topological degeneracy. And actually, my interest went backwards from topological degeneracy. Thought that the index theorem I applied to it, and thank you. And graphene was a nice physical system that people had studied, and I could see if the theories or the models we developed apply to a realistic system that people did numerics and so on. And what Da Vinci has to do with it is that he drew it a lot with charcoal and pencil, much to the annoyance of the art preservation people. And graphene is basically two-dimensional layers of graphite, right? So that's really the story. I would like to acknowledge collaboration with Agapitos Hadzinikitas, who is a cousin of mine in Greece, and Michael Stone, who is at Illinois. And so before going into the topic of my talk, let me just tell you briefly what things we've been working on in Leeds, and so that, you know, if you like to discuss later on, then we can pick them up. One thing is in collaboration with Harald Weinfurter's group at Max Planck Institute to simulate anionic statistics with photons. So that has actually lots of advantages because you don't have dynamical phase and so on, which spoil the anionic statistics. Hopefully we'll have some results in a month or two. The second thing is we work on Kitaev's honeycomb lattice model. And that's, you know, extending the work Kitaev did to find the exact energies of the vortices, the energy of the fermions that exist in the theory, the interactions between vortices. So these studies are done for zero magnetic field and non-zero magnetic field, which produces the non-abelian phase. And also, we study when this non-abelian phase it breaks down for strong magnetic field and such questions. Another system we're looking at is frustration of cold atoms in optical lattices. So this is a one-dimensional optical lattice, where a second dimension is encoded in the atom. So effectively, we have a ladder, and we have competing interactions. So this creates frustration. But surprisingly, a proper transformation, just a simple transformation, diagonalizes the system, and you can exactly solve many of the limiting coupling cases. So, and actually, one way to solve it analytically is to use Majorana fermions and so on that is used by Kitaev. And one of the characteristics it shows is the breakdown of superfluidity. Even if you have large tunneling couplings, fragmentation of the superfluid, and so on. And another system that is more recent and it's very exciting is we're looking at the triangular lattice with chiral interaction terms. This is more or less a Hamiltonian we're working on different lattice systems. And what we're interested in the ground state degeneracy and observing if there are any chiral spin liquid states and so on. So all these works and other parts are done with, let me acknowledge my students here, James Wooten, Ville Latine, and Kristen Temme, and especially collaboration with Juanjo Ripoll and Dimitris Tsomokos in these two subjects. I'm not going to talk about anions, even if I mainly work about it, but let me just mention misspelled anion, a historical mistake. That's a letter. So that's. Let me take you a few centuries back when the electrolysis experiment was performed. Then we had all these new exciting phenomena appearing and characteristics. And people were much interested about how to define things, what particles we have, and so on. And that's a letter that exists in Cambridge at Trinity College Library. And it's a series of letters exchanged by Faraday and Whewell. And this is sent by Faraday himself. And he says, "I have taken your advice, and the names used are anode, cathode, anions, cations, and ions. The last I shall have but little occasion for." So that's a very ironic history. So I think as ions made it well through and survived, much more popular than the anode and cathode particles. Nice term for the anions too.
How does it spell anions?
It's with A-N-I. Yes, yes, well. So let me go now to the subject of my talk, really. What is graphene? Is this hexagonal or honeycomb lattice, two-dimensional lattice, which has carbon atoms sitting on the vertices. Different geometrical configurations I will be talking about are, for example, the fullerene, which is a sphere, or prolongated sphere, and nanotubes, which are just two-dimensional periodic in one direction. So what we will be interested into are the zero modes of these particles and the zero energy modes of these systems, which actually the number of them will be as a function of the geometry of your graphene sheet. Why the zero modes are actually related to the conducting properties of these materials, and that's the much excitement about it, because people are interested to build miniaturized elements of based on graphene or nanotubes and so on for circuits. And of course, that would be fantastic because it's very, very conducting, and if it is conducting, and with huge velocities of the electrons, as we will see. And that's a dream for computer building. The second player of my talk is the index theorem, introduced by T.N. Singer sometime in the early 60s. And what it says is many fancy words like smooth, orientable, compact, Riemannian, manifold, and genus, and so on. You can take these definitions aboard or not if you. What I really would like to keep is that we have an elliptic operator D, okay, defined on a two-dimensional manifold M. And this elliptic operator might be a Hamiltonian, which is coupled with a curvature of your two-dimensional surface, or a Gauge field, or and a Gauge field. Okay, so I have these both elements. And what the index theorem does is to relate the zero modes, or the zero eigenstates, if you like, of this operator as a function of the topological characteristics of my surface. Okay, if I have a genus, or if I have any open ends. So that's what, for that I will use the Euler characteristic, and let me just show you some geometrical figures here. This is a sphere, which has genus zero. This is a torus with genus equals one, and this is more or less equivalent with a cylinder with two open ends, and that has two open ends, I call has a number n equals 2 that I'm going to use later on. And this is a torus with genus 2, and that's equivalent with two crossed or two combined cylinders that will have n equals 4 and g equals 0, but it has n equals 0, g equals 2. Something we'll see that the topology actually does influence the conductivity in the sense of the number of zero modes it creates. And why we are interested into that is for topological quantum computation. Why I initially start from that is that if you have, let's say, G, capital G number of zero modes, then your degeneracy, because each zero mode is fermionic for my Dirac operator, it can be either populated or empty. So I have two states for each mode, and effectively I have 2 to the number G degenerate states related to this to this Hamiltonian, this geometric topological configuration. Now, I have a degeneracy, ground state degeneracy, which depends on topology. So that's one of the two characteristics I need for topological degeneracy, for encoding information there and manipulating it and being protected topologically. The other characteristic is that it shouldn't be this degenerate state shouldn't be distinguished locally with local operators, okay? And it's a big question still in my mind if that characteristic is or is not satisfied by the construction I'll show you. Anyways, such very interesting models with topological degeneracy are introduced by Kitayev's Torrey code, the Honeycomb lattice, the Kikobe lattice, extended Hubbard model, and so on. So these are actually, the Kitayev's Honeycomb lattice is very similar to graphene, but instead of fermions, we have real fermions, the Majorana fermions. So that's what I'm saying here is as applies there as well. Graphene, let me show you some pictures. Fullerene, geometrical configuration of graphene, spherical geometry. This is exactly the same as a football, the old-fashioned one with pentagons indicated by black faces. So and hexagons are white. So you need 12 pentagons in order to make a hexagonal lattice into genus zero. And that's some pictures of some fullerenes, but that much bigger than the C60, of course, so that we can portray them here. Well, nanotubes are basically two-dimensional sheets which are with one periodic condition. And, of course, I could combine them in many different ways, so I would get different types of nanotubes with different properties. Now, these guys, you can put them in between electrodes. Here is one of them. And you can measure their conductivity and so on. But, to be honest, I won't be talking much about the conductivity and how you derive it. That I leave it to the experts to do. Here is a picture that actually is promising for thinking more complicated geometries. Instead of just nanotubes, you could have three type of vertices and eventually having crossed nanotubes and so on. So more complicated geometries are also possible. They're not unrealistic. So let me take you slowly through graphene because I think it's very interesting. And I think many of that apply to different systems, like for the quantum Hall of Please.
Is it known what happens where the fork occurs on the previous slide, the microscopic step?
Pardon?
Is the microscopic structure, is there a seven-sided gon there or several seven-sided gons?
I will go into that, how many you need and what the effect.
But experimentally, is it known what that corresponds to?
I don't know. I really just Googled and found the picture.
I mean, for other characteristic reasons, you know there has to be more than six sides for several of the faces there. But
indeed,
exactly
yes.
Exactly what combination is present is what I was asking about.
I will go into the theoretically. Experimentally, they have these multi-million dollar machines building these molecules. So
did they make that intentionally, or was that just a defect?
They heat up some. I think for the nanotubes, you just heat up the samples and you pick up several ones and you take pictures of them. For graphene, they grow them up with machines. And actually, that's a nice story. That's you need really expensive machines to do that. And eventually, a Russian guy came around and took a sticky tape and put it on graphite, took it out, dissolved it. Some liquid, and they had perfect sheets of graphene and with pocket money, all right? So that exploded the field, actually. We need more ideas like that, I think. for topological quantum computation. So let me go through a bit graphene, all right? And I'll do it a bit slowly. Because I'm a fan of lattices instead of continuums. I think there are many applications here with these methods. Hexagonal lattice, the Hamiltonian is completely simple. You have just a fermion hopping from one side to the other with tunneling coupling T. For my convenience, I split the hexagonal lattice or the honeycomb lattice into two triangular lattices. So each blue is connected only with orange ones, and each orange connected only with blue ones. And I call the orange ones A and the blue ones, the blue fermions B. So I build it like that. So I have a 2x2 structure of my Hamiltonian, which then I can perform a Fourier transformation, and has this off-diagonal form. Okay? So these U and V vectors are these unit vectors on each lattice. And of course, for the other triangular lattice, you have minus signs here of those ones. So here you are. This is the K component of it, of your Hamiltonian. And you can diagonalize it and find the energies related to it. So you have plus and minus this thing that you usually see it as a picture. So this is the energy on this axis, and this is a two-dimensional momentum space, px and py. These are like crowns, okay, that have 6 points that they intersect, and they have the amazing characteristic of having individual Fermi points, not lines or anything where the energy is zero. This is zero energy. That's fantastic. Why? Because that determines a lot the behavior of your system near these points. So if I make half filling of fermions of my system, that means that if I make my system have energies up to here, I can do it if I have fermions, I can fill in the Fermi-C and come up to there. I can see how the system behaves near this point. So I linearize. I find these K points, I pick up one, for example, here, and I expand the momentum near this point, so P is small here, right? So here you see 6 points, but actually there are two independent ones, okay? And basically I'll pick up the K plus and the K minus, which are one is opposite to the other. So after I expand, I find K from this expression, setting it equal to zero. I substitute back to the Hamiltonian, and I linearize it around P. I can linearize it because, you know, it's a conical intersection here. It's linear in both X and Y directions. So my Hamiltonian actually takes this form, which is nothing else but the Dirac operator in two dimensions. So here you are. You have relativistic quantum mechanics on the tip of your pencil. That's indeed what graphene leaves. You have the eigenstates of the system are spinors, right? Two-dimensional vectors that the first component is on the lattice A, okay, the orange size, and the second dimension is the lattice B, the blue sides, and also have plus and minus corresponds to expanding around this point or expanding around the other Fermi point. So I have two vectors corresponding to each Dirac equation, to each Fermi point. Now, something you would like to keep in mind is that the sigma z Pauli operator, if it acts on this Hamiltonian, anti-commutes. So basically what it does is changing the momentum from P to minus P. One direction sends you on the other way around. Now, what I'm interested into are funny geometries of graphene, not really on the flat sheet, but that's also interesting. But for applying my index theorem, I need some compact manifolds like fullerenes or nanotubes and so on. So we have to introduce curvature on this flat sheet. How can we do it? Is take a pi over 3 sector here, cut it out, and then glue together opposite ends. Okay? Very dramatic thing to do. And you have to make sure that continuity of your wave function of your spinors is preserved. And
that destroys translational symmetry, so doesn't it destroy the entire momentum discussion, momentum space picture? In other words, on your previous slide, what you did is you Fourier transformed to the extent possible, and you were left over with a two-dimensional operator in real space because of, it's not a Bravais lattice, but they're two sides per fundamental domain.
Yeah.
That's an important feature, right?
So here, what I get is if I take this part out, I introduce a pentagon here because I have to glue this side with that side to connect these two sides, but all the rest of the lattice is still hexagons. So basically I have again hexagonal lattice everywhere except of one defect. So I have to see what the effect of this defect is. Now, with the previous structure, I found some spinors, right, that I could define everywhere on my lattice. One of them is defined on the blue ones and the other one is on the orange ones. In order to make this cutting and gluing together a continuum again, a continuous function, I'm talking about the position space here, right? Well, let me take care of it in the position space.
Will you have a momentum discussion later, or is that gone once you break translational symmetry by putting in curvature?
Yes, I will see what the effects of the defect is on my position operator. Yeah.
Well, but if you're far away from the point of the defect, locally this looks like a flat flat lattice because the Gaussian curvature is zero. So you can still think in terms of momentum, and then there's going to be a point defect, and we can look at scattering or something else.
Actually, indeed, I will have a small discussion about this particular effect in a few slides later on. Exactly this point.
Gaussian curvature is zero because it's a conical.
I would like to devote a bit of time on that in a few slides. But let me see what in the momentum in the position space how I can rectify this discontinuity. Okay, if I transform my spinner around, or if I transform orthogonal set or basis set, then that will have a rotation here missing of pi over 3. And I can rectify it by introducing a spin connection Q with a circulation around my pentagon to be pi over 6 sigma z. So I have pi over 6 for one component, pi over 6 for the other. So I get a pi over 3 I was initially doing here. So this sigma z mixes the components of my Dirac spinner. Now here's something a little bit more involved. Here I go from blue to orange, blue, orange, blue, and then blue again. So that's a frustration term, okay? That's exactly the same if I go around a magnetic solenoid, a solenoid of magnetic field, flux, and then I come back and my wave function is not continuous anymore, got a different value. In order to rectify, I have to introduce a connection, a vector potential on my Hamiltonian to undo, let's say, this effect. And exactly the same thing I have to do here. I have to introduce a non-abelian field that will mix between the different Fermi points or the different components of my spinner and rectify this blue to blue into blue, orange, blue.
Are the two components of the spinner interchanged as you go around this defect?
Yes. Things are a little bit more complicated. You have to study really what transformation takes you from here to there and what transformation takes you to opposite points. And then you will find out that by subtracting these two, you will find out the value of what the circulation of your connection will be around the pentagon. So it's not straightforward like that. It's a little bit more involving. But we can discuss it later. So basically, this operator, what it does, it mixes between the two different spinners. Okay, it doesn't mix between the components of the spinners, as you would rather expect from this picture, but it does actually has to mix between the two different spinners. Basically, it couples the two different Fermi points. fantastic, right? You get really interesting physics out of it. But what I can do is, because this is the only term that mixes between the two different Dirac equations, that I put them now together, I made a four spinner thing, a 4x4 Dirac operator. I could make a unitary transformation and diagonalize it. I have again two by two Dirac equations, okay, written here for k equals 1 and k equals 2. That diagonalizes non-abelian connection, makes it abelian, and I have plus and minus pi over 2 circulation of this connection around the pentagons. Now, this will be my elliptic operator I'll be using for the index theorem. Let me just write it again here, this operator, and I present you this slide not to show you that I can copy successfully equations from Weinberg's book on relativity, but to show you that this equation actually has a Gates potential related coupled to it. It has curvature actually here. So you have the spin connection, you have the momentum, and these gammas are actually written in terms of Zweibein's, Christoffel Simbol's curvatures, Ricci scalar curvature here. Okay? So really, we're doing the full thing. And now let me come back to this point that Michael raised. This is a continuous equation defined on the continuum, while my system is defined on a lattice. Okay? This approximation holds if I have large wavelengths. Okay? Large wavelengths means small frequencies, which in turn means small energies. That's exactly what I demanded, that I'm going near the Fermi points, and I am discussing the physics near the Fermi points, small energy fluctuations around zero. Okay? That's where this equation would be valid for describing this lattice system. Small energies, large wavelengths. Now, if I have large wavelength, it means that the lattice spacing will not be visible, will seem like infinitesimally small. So it will seem that it's moving on a continuum. Also, if I have a conical singularity there, my large wavelength will not be able to distinguish it. Okay, so it will look like a smooth surface at that point. Of course, in order to be able, my system to be able to support large wavelengths, it means that the system itself has to be large enough. So if it's small, then the largest wavelength can go from one side to the other. Okay? So for small systems, compared to the lattice spacing, this approximation will break down, and the larger I make my system, the more lattice sides I have, the better this equation of the continuum will approximate the lattice system. And we will see exactly that happening in the numerics. Please.
What is the index k?
The index k is, so I had this 4x4 Dirac equation, and I diagonalized the connection. I made this 2x2, so I have two 2x2 Dirac equations, and k is for one of them and for the other, in distinguishing between these two of them. So basically what it does is puts a minus sign on the, gives you circulation plus pi over 2 or minus pi over 2. On the connection here. And you have the corresponding spinors on that.
So your indices for psi are, okay, spin, and then node, and then plus minus k?
The plus and minus k, I diagonalized, I made it now this
okay.
little k, index 1 and 2.
So the gamma is a 4x4 matrix, right?
No, these are 2x2.
Oh, the 2x2.
Yeah, this after I diagonalized my Dirac operator. Yes, that's two by two indicated by k here.
Did the gammas change, or is this you're just writing down general formulae?
You mean after I make the...
If I
make it in the flat case, the gammas will be the Pauli matrices or some 4x4 generalizations of them. But if I introduce curvature, then I have to introduce this Fairbanks just by seeing what the transformation properties of XY basis vectors are around my defect.
But the current problem is the same.
In the curved space, I have to take Zweibeins here.
But for the problem with just one pentagon, do they change or not?
They do change, yes. Because you have curvature. So effectively, a conic, you know, if I take this pi over 3 sector out, I have a pentagon, I have a conical shape there, I have a curvature related to it. Please.
Maybe the same question is, where does the G mu mu come into the blue box there?
Right, so this gamma mu are basically it's phi minus e mu a gamma a, where gamma a are the Pauli matrices. So g mu nu comes in with this Zweibeins. I have to redefine my Dirac operator to live on this curved now manifold. So I have to introduce the gamma matrices, the Clifford algebra on the curved space. In the same way as I introduced the spin connection here for taking care of the curvature and the vector potential.
Mm-hmm. So what's the eta AB or whatever that?
This is a flat delta AB. That's a flat delta AB. So let me point out that the vector potential we have here is an effective gauge theory, right? I didn't have any magnetic fields at the beginning, but I had to introduce it in order to account for the frustration defect there.
A little confusing. What's the difference between Q mu and A mu after you did this diagonalization? So that
Q mu
index is not being summed over.
So basically, the diagonalization acts only on the vector potential because it's the only term that couples between the two different spinners. So I can perform a rotation which does not change your Q, but it changes A. It diagonalizes A and makes it a billion in that case.
But so automatically, the only difference is that Q mu is the same for both cases, while A mu is different.
Right, indeed, yes. So that's all I had to say about graphing, right? And let me go into the index theorem and... that thing, I hope that everybody understands, you know, that's you can ask me questions here. So I had the elliptic operator, right? Let me build it now in a different way. Consider two operators, P and P dagger. And what it does is P takes you from a vector space V plus to V minus, and P dagger takes you from V minus to V plus. Abstract vector spaces. Okay?
V plus is related to sub-lattice space or?
Pardon me?
What is V plus and V minus in terms of graphing?
I will talk about it in a minute. Okay? But let me speak a bit general now because you can apply it also to different things. Now, consider the P dagger P operator, and this takes you from V plus to V plus, for example. Right? And because it goes all the way from here to there. And I want to see the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of it. So if this operator has an eigenvector u with eigenvalue lambda, then you know by multiplying here by p that the pp dagger has an eigenvector, namely pu, with the same eigenvalue. So, and that happens only if lambda is different than zero. So I can prove that only for lambda different than zero. So if P dagger P has an eigenvalue lambda, then you know that PP dagger has the same eigenvalue. That holds for degeneracies, for everything. Okay? So the two spectrums come in pairs. Now, let's define a Dirac operator now. That relates you, actually, to graphing somehow. A 2x2 matrix, and I put P dagger and P in the off-diagonal elements. But what I would be interested into is this square. That would simplify my life a lot, because this is a diagonal matrix, P dagger, P and P, P dagger. And it acts on the vector space direct sum of V plus plus V minus. Right, I said that. And this actually has the same number of zero modes as D. Okay? So instead of looking at the zero modes of this, I will look at the zero modes of that diagonal operator. Now, completely for bookkeeping purposes and nothing more, maybe to scare you a bit, I define this matrix gamma 5, which is 1 when it acts on V plus and minus 1 when it acts of V minus. Okay? Completely to tell you what eigenvectors come from one vector space and which ones come from the other vector space. And basically what it does, it gives you a plus sign if it's V plus and a minus sign or eigenvalue if it comes from the V minus. Now, consider that the number of zero energy modes coming for V plus are nu plus in number, right? There are nu plus zero modes that live in the V plus space. And there are nu minus zero modes that live in that space. Basically, when I say that something lives here, I mean vectors which are on the basis of 1, 0, two-dimensional vectors on the space 1, 0, okay? And the vectors which live in V minus, they are on the basis 0, 1. Just that. Then this sigma z operator, this is the eigenstates of this sigma z operator. Very simple things I'm talking about. And now let's build this object here. This is the trace, and this of gamma 5, sigma z, exponential minus t, t is a general parameter, right? D square. Okay? Just let's look at this object. We'll make the inside much better. Now, this trace runs over matrix indices and as well as the continuum indices, expectation values in integration. So if I take the matrix trace, what I have is the eigenvalues of this square split in two parts as eigenstates of gamma 5. And so if I take care of this gamma 5 eigenvalues, I have first the ones with plus sign, and basically this living V plus, where P dagger P is acting. And with a minus sign, the ones which act for the states in V minus, where the P dagger is acting, right? And also I know that the non-zero states, okay, the non-zero eigenvalues of these two operators, they come in pairs. I have a minus sign, so they will cancel out completely, except possibly for the zero energy modes. This will be, so here I will have the zero modes will give me one, so I'll have a sum over all the ones, all the zero modes contribute to one. I will build up a new plus, minus the new minus, sum over ones of the zero modes of that operator. And because that may be non-zero, it may be an interesting object to look at. And let's give it a name. Let's call it index of the operator.
Janusz, from the second line, isn't it also true that P of a zero mode is still a zero mode?
Well, P's, you see, because...
Just suppose lambda equals zero on your second line.
Sorry, second line, you mean here?
Yeah, say lambda equals zero and see what you get.
Yes, you won't be able to carry out this argument.
Maybe they don't bijective one-to-one, but it still looks like if you apply P in front, that you still conclude that PP dagger applied to PU is zero. Is that right?
Yes, but I think you can't...
What's that? PU minus PU is zero.
Yes,
zero.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Something that we have to take from here as well is that this expression is surprisingly t-independent. So I had a t-parameter here. What I got out at the end is t-independent. Okay, all these magical coincidences. Now, let's connect it to what we had before. We had a two-dimensional Dirac operator coupled to a gauge field and curvature. Please.
Stupid question. The index of a matrix, of a finite matrix, like that D, has to be zero or can it be anything?
It could be anything. You could build examples actually where your P's are not even square matrices, 1, 0, 0, 0, and the P dagger is 1, 0, 0 on that side.
These are square matrices, though.
They don't have to be square matrices.
But it is square at the index of 0, because it's the kernel minus co-kernel.
Yep, yeah, exactly. That's why this will give you more interest in indices if you take this as.
If it's square, it's only 0, but if it's not square, it's infinite square matrices will give you non-zero?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I mean, like, the if I take a Dirac operator with a differential, these are like infinite matrices.
In graphing, you have the same number of A and B sides, so you're always stuck with square matrices in this case. Right?
Yes, but an infinite square, yes.
An infinite square, yes.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So if I take now this square there, I get my Laplacian, which has the the covariant derivatives here, so it has the connection as well in there. And I have the field strength, the gauge field here. And I have a curvature. You can do the calculation. It's a bit messy with the indices. All right. And now I want to build exactly the same object as I had before, this exponential funny function. And I will use the heat kernel expansion method for evaluating the index theorem. And basically what it tells you is that the trace of f e to the minus td is equal to 1 in two dimensions, okay, I restrict that, 1 over 4 pi t, a sum of powers of t with certain coefficients ak, which depend on f and d. Okay, that I take for granted. Now, I substitute f to be gamma 5 and d to be the Dirac operator squared, and see what I get. Now, I expect to get a t-independent function. Or I have to get a t-independent expression here. And the only way to be t-independent is that if all the ak's are zero, except of a2, then I take a t here and another t here, and they will cancel out. I have to get that. That's the previous evaluation what gave me.
How did you get that formula for the?
I took it from a book again. Yeah. you could expand term by term and calculate it, and actually.
Oh, you could expand it in the.
Yeah, the exponential. Yeah, exactly, and that's actually something that gives you the taste how to calculate. The A2 basically will be the expansion of the exponential, and the first term it will give you some contributions with which come in here. The second term will be the linear one in T, which will cancel this T, and basically will bring you this operator with the matrix and the curvature term in. And indeed, that's what it is. It's a trace of gamma 5 of these terms. This is scalar, it doesn't have any matrices in it. So trace gamma 5 is 0 with this term. So actually the curvature drops out as a characteristic of two dimensions. But here I have a matrix. And actually it's again sigma z with an I factor. So trace of gamma 5 squared is 1. And here I get my field strength contribution to this term. So what we have, let me put together the two last slides. I calculate this one way with the eigenvalues. I got the index. I calculate it with the Higg kernel method. I got this total flux of the field strength. And I'm very much tempted to equate the two. But I have to be careful. This is an integer. At least I don't know if it's an integer, right? In order to make it an integer, I have to impose that my manifold is compact. In that case, this is actually the total number of monopole charges inside my compact surface, which has to be an integer due to the Dirac quantization condition. Okay? Of course, why monopoles? They don't exist in nature, but my Gates theory is an effective one. It's not the real one. So basically, when I introduce pentagons, it's like introducing monopole charges. It's equivalent to introducing monopole charges inside my surface, giving you pure flux going outwards. So in that case, I can identify these two terms. And that's an integer, indeed. And this is also a topological number in the sense that it won't be affected by small deformations of my surface, okay? Geometrical deformations, or if I apply some real magnetic fields going through it, it won't be affected. This expression will stay the same. And what it gives me is the least number of zero modes, because I have a difference here, you see. So if both of them are non-zero, then I'm losing some zero modes from the difference. But what happens is that if this is different than zero, in dramatically most of the cases, one of them is zero. So actually, I will get the full number of zero modes if this is non-zero. If this is zero, these are allowed to be zero, equal, as we will see actually in one of the examples.
What does it mean now for your perform that you have to have a compact manifold?
Pardon me?
What does it mean for the graphene?
I'll come to that.
You made this comment that most of the time when the difference is non-zero, one of them has to be zero.
And yes. By experience.
I mean,
very, very twisted cases.
You have edges in the system or things like that?
Very twisted cases give you both of them non-zero when the total flux is non-zero. I don't know.
Also, the number of zero nodes is not protected, so presumably you can deform your system, spread your EMU a little bit around, and you can eliminate all zero nodes except, some of them will stay so that the difference is non-zero.
If you put edges into your system, you're deforming your matrix in such a way that you can't produce your modes in graphene. If you do it right. If you have zigzag edges, you can produce zero non-dispersive modes.
I think in many circumstances it's generic that co-kernel has dimension zero. I mean, after all, if you introduce a random perturbation, you expect the image to be onto. It's a degenerate case when the image misses some directions.
So you need new one of those is
the second one. New minus is usually zero.
Okay. Please.
I guess going back to this question of finite matrices. I guess strictly speaking, we do have finite matrices. You had a lattice system, so somehow in taking the continuum, this all comes in. How does that?
This is these are differential operators.
Well, okay, but they start off as a type binding. You started off with a type binding rule, so in a compact manner, I guess you have a number of sides.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So there must be some subtlety of the.
In the continuum.
Continuum limit. How does it? If I have a real piece of graphene, what does it actually? Or real finite size system, what does it actually?
Yes, indeed. That we will see it later coming up. I mean, basically. Your zero modes will not be exactly zero modes, basically. That's the discrepancy. But you can see it actually in the numerics explicitly. Right, so let me come now to another very fun thing. The Euler characteristic, right? So, let's have a lattice, okay? A two-dimensional, which has a two-dimensional surface, it can have a certain genus, and also could have certain open ends. And let me just draw what an open end is. This is a face here, a face here, a face here, and a face here, but there's not a face here. That means an open end. Okay? So in the Euler characteristic, so it's basically the number of vertices there minus the number of edges plus the number of faces is equal to 2, 1 minus g, where g is the genus of the surface where my lattice is defined on, minus n, where n is the number of such empty faces. Now, how I will take them is basically I will use them in a continuum sense. That is, I will do. Okay, so I will have. I can map between G and N's. Okay, so if I have. Let me put it that way. If I have a torus with G equals 1, then I can cut it in two places. I have, or in one place. I have a torus, or I have n equals 2.
Cylinder.
I will have a cylinder, indeed. So that's why what we will talk about actually identify a cylinder and a torus. So whenever the surfaces I will be using, or the lattice I will be using, they demand a continuum endpoints to be that they can be glued together in a continuous way. Smooth. Now, the other assumption I'm going to use is that the minimal, I will demand minimal violation of my lattice. So when I introduce curvature, I either introduce pentagons or heptagons, right? Pentagons will give me positive curvature, heptagons will give me negative curvature. Can use many of them, but I won't go into squares or triangles. It's possible to study this case as well, but I will isolate here. Actually, this Euler characteristic has been proven by Cauchy when he was 20 years old, one of these stories that make you feel sad and so on. But it's called Euler characteristic, not Cauchy. So. Now, let's play the game a little bit, right? So let's take this lattice and assume that I have N5 pentagons, N6 hexagons, and N7 heptagons. And assume that actually I will have, each vertex will have three edges connecting it, right? I will consider only such lattices. So the number of vertices I will have is each pentagon will have 5 vertices, hexagon 6, heptagon 7, but each vertex is shared between 3 faces, so I have to divide by 3. The same thing with the edges, 5 for the pentagons and so on, but each edge is shared by 2 faces, so I have to divide by 2. Or 2 polygons, so I have to divide by 2. And the number of faces is just the sum of the polygons I will have. So I substitute this back here, and we find that basically N6 drops out, and the what you have is the difference between N5 minus N7 is equal to 6 times the Euler characteristic, which is basically this number here. So if I create a lattice, hexagonal lattice with pentagons and heptagons, the topology of the lattice, the genus, for example, this I will relate it to genus just by doubling my surface. So if I have 2 open ends, for example, I double my surface here and connect it, so I have genus 1. So by a doubling process here, I can make this capital N into a genus. And of course, if you have two of them, you get one genus. Or if you have one genus, you cut it, you get two of them. Okay? Two ends. But it's crucial that my connection should be continuous there. So let's see how much this holds. For a Fullerene, I have j equals 0 and n equals 0. So that gives 0 here. Oh, sorry, it gives 12 here. So I need 12 pentagons to create a football. Okay, I knew that, right? For a nanotube, I have j equals 0 and n equals 2. And indeed, in that case, this becomes 0. So I have 0 pentagons or heptagons. That's actually my flat sheet, which I just put a periodic condition. I can add in pentagons and heptagons, equal numbers of them. Basically, they take care of the curvature, okay, to be equal. Also the flux. The pentagon gives you positive flux, the heptagon gives you negative flux. So that also cancels the two effects out.
So the genus and the number of open ends are not directly linked when one with each other?
Pardon me?
The genus and the number of open ends are not directly linked with each other?
Is M? Yes, yes, they're directly related to each other.
But it's not something like it's just one hole, two open ends, two holes, four open ends, and so on. It's not just.
Yes, yes, it's just like that, yes.
And why is the G equals 0 and N equals 2?
Well, you could have. What do you mean? I mean, if I. This is given by a nanotube. A nanotube has N equals 2 and G equals 0. If I had a torus, then I have G equals 1 and N equals 0. And in that case, you get exactly the same answer, because that's exactly. They're both. Homeomorphic to a flat surface, if you like.
But they're not related. I think, you know, say if you start from a cube, you could take out one face, so a cube has genus
zero.
So you could take out one face or two faces. Or that's not true.
So let me play the game here. Imagine I have this link, right? And I have faces everywhere, but not here and there. I don't have faces here, right? Now I can cut this link. I take 1, 2, 3, 4 edges out, right? The number of vertices is the same. And how many faces do I take out? 1, 2, 3, 4. So I have here 4 minus 4. So the Euler characteristic stays the same if I cut. Here I don't have faces. Let me point that out again. Okay, these are the open edges will give me 2, n equals 2 generated. You can imagine that was on a torus. So the Euler characteristic is the same if you go from one to the other. 1g gives you 2n's, factor of 2.
Did you understand? I didn't understand.
All right, sorry.
So I think my problem is if you take a cube, can you just take out one phase? Would this also be an open end or not?
It has to be continuous. So it has to be able to connect it in a continuous way. What do I mean by that is that in the case of graphene, you have to be able to connect the two open ends by only inserting hexagons, not pentagons or heptagons. That's what I mean continuous. Okay? It has to be flat connection, if you like.
Was your question what happens if you take a cube and remove one face?
Yeah.
Then the Euler characteristic goes from 2 to 1. You go from a sphere to a disk.
Yes.
Okay.
You subtract one because you remove one face. Faces count positive, vertices count positive, edges count negative.
But then if you remove two faces?
Then you get 0. You start with 2 for a sphere, remove one space, 2 minus 1 is 1. Remove another disjoint face.
How about
the two adjacent edges? Well, then the edge between them also disappears. And the edge is not negative. So that's why it stays one.
But in terms of the genus doesn't
genus
change.
Genus is zero in all these discussions if you start with a cube, because any subset of a sphere has genus zero.
Well, what is confusing is that n seems to change depending on how many faces you took out, but g stays the same, and the it changes.
That's right. So n is the number of boundary components, if you like.
So if you take out two adjacent faces,
n is 1. But the mystery, I mean, the reason the arithmetic works is because when you remove two adjacent faces, you've accidentally removed the edge that joined them.
Yeah,
so
but
in terms of Euler characters, it looks like you just remove one face, because you remove two faces and one edge.
Okay.
The edge counts with the opposite side.
But the reason it caused confusion is because the formula for the Euler characteristics, well, there were two expressions. One of them included edges, but the other only counted G and M.
Mm-hmm.
We have the expression, what was it, 2 times 1 minus G minus N. It doesn't have any edges in it. So here the question is how to properly count N. And you're saying that if there are two joint faces, N is still one, not two. If I remove two faces, which are touching each other.
Yes.
That was the
question. I think that's his definition of N, the number of boundary components.
So N is on boundary.
I will demand that any faces I take out, they can be reconnected in a continuous way, only as a flat connections. So I don't want to have any adjacent faces removed in this formula. Right. So let me go back to what we had, to graphene, right? So that was a fun ride, but we need results. And I had the index to be equal to the total flux. I had a way to enumerate. So the total flux here is also given by the circulation of your connection due to the Stokes theorem. And I know the circulation of my connection for each pentagon. So basically, the total flux will be the sum of the circulations around each pentagon, or heptagon, if you like. Now, let's come to this side. I have 1 over 2 pi. The circulation around each pentagon is plus or minus pi over 2. And also note the net number of N5 minus N7. And if I multiply the whole thing together, I find that that's either plus or minus 3 over 2 chi, where chi is my Euler characteristic. So I can calculate this exactly knowing the genus and the number of open faces on my lattice.
So let me ask, just to clarify, so the bundle on which you're defining the curvature is the threefold tensor power of the tangent bundle for your surface, is that correct? I mean, the point is geometrically, you think a pentagon would represent a flux of pi over 6. That would be true for tangent vectors. If you do parallel transport of a tangent vector, using the flat geometry around the pentagon, it rotates 60 degrees, pi over 6.
But these are the curvature you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm asking where the curvature lives. It doesn't live in, just for clarification, just so I understand.
Please.
I want to assert that the curvature does not live in the tangent bundle, but it lives in an associated bundle. And the associated bundle is, I assume, is the threefold tensor power of the tangent bundle, because I see pi over 2 in your formula instead of pi over 6. It's three times as twisted as the tangent bundle.
You mean this one? Or?
No, one line up. Pi over 2.
Oh, the pi over 2 came...
Yeah, but because it came from a calculation. And the point is, it's different from...
It didn't have to do with the pi over 3 segment I took out. It had to do that my lattice, if I go around it, I go from one triangular lattice to the same triangular lattice. That was a discontinuity. That's where it came from. It didn't come from the pi over 3. Effectively came by connecting the opposite ends of a pi over 3 segment.
Right. I don't know whether you can answer this question in your language, but when I speak of curvature, it's the curvature of a connection, which is in your language, a potential.
Right.
So it's the field of associated potential.
Indeed.
But mathematician would like to know where this lives. What's the name of the bundle that the connection is on?
Mm-hmm.
The answer must be not the tangent bundle, but it's some spinner bundle.
Indeed, it's a spin bundle.
And
indeed,
so
yes.
The dimension
very
of
good
the
point.
Bundle is it two real dimensions or four real dimensions?
Indeed, that's quite nice. I had a hexagonal lattice, right? And where did I define my spin components? I mean, I'm talking about spinners here in Dirac equations. So basically, my spin component is, so I had also the two different lattices, the two different triangular lattices. So the third spin component lives on the filled circles, and the second spin component lives on the empty circles, right? So these are my spin half object that the Dirac equation describes. Basically, superpositions of these two triangular lattices. And this is a new, actually, space. It's not actually a tangent bundle. I have to add it an additional structure to my manifold. That's where the curvature of the field strength lies
so,
in.
So it's a bundle of two or four complex dimensions?
So this I had two-dimensional ones that I wrote as a four-dimensional spinner that I diagonalized back to two-by-two-dimensional spinners. So I have two for each Fermi point, two vector for each Fermi point. So I have two Fermi points.
So this plus minus refers to this two?
Yes, exactly. This plus minus, it's one for each Fermi point.
Okay, but regardless of the dimension bundle, is it true that the curvature is scalar? That is,
the geometrical curvature is a scalar, and it drops out from the index in two dimensions. I had to trace the scalar curvature with gamma 5, and the trace of gamma 5 is 0, so it doesn't appear in. Here I have only the curvature of the connection, of the field strength, if you like. I have the field strength.
Right, but there are no indices on the F anymore, so I assume that
the... It's 1, 2, yeah.
It's like
F1, 2.
So you have two abelian gauge fields. One of them gives plus, the other gives minus. So
which is...
So I think that's just different language for saying curvature acts as a scalar. If you do a polynomial around a loop, it multiplies the vector by a scalar as opposed to a matrix?
Yes, because I diagonalize the connection, yeah.
Okay. So saying the curvature is scalar is probably the mathematical language for saying it's an abelian gauge.
Yes.
Okay.
Indeed. Thank you, yes. So... Now, so for each Fermi point, so for each k, basically, I have 3 over 2 chi and minus 3 over 2 chi for the index. But these are two Dirac equations that I have to hold simultaneously. So my original Dirac equation I was interested in is a 4 by 4 one. Okay? So a zero mode of the total equation is the sum of the zero modes of each individual ones. Okay? You can put zeros on the other components and on the other way around to extend them. It's a direct sum, if you like. So the total least number of zero modes you could have is the sum of the two, or the absolute values of the two, which is 6 absolute value 1 minus g plus 3n. And that's the number we have to take with us. That's the total number that we got from the index theorem. And let's check how good this reproduces, how well it reproduces known results on graphene. I mean, actually, that's the page why I chose graphene here, because people did extensive numerics and extensive theoretical studies with it. And I mean, finding the zero modes in a lattice Hamiltonian is not the easiest thing. A two-dimensional subject is not the easiest thing. So, but people studied that, and here you are. What do we have? This is, let's take the case of C60. You have zero genus, and the number of faces missing is zero. Here is the degree of degeneracy. So either you have twofold modes degeneracy, and so on. And this is the, please?
Why did the sign change? It used to be 6-1 minus g minus 3m without absolute
values. I took absolute values.
You took absolute value of that.
I could have the minus sign, but I should have an absolute value here and absolute value everywhere. So.
Okay, and when you take absolute value, it also then depends on whether 1 minus g is positive or negative.
So either I'm interested if this is equal to 0 or 1 or 2. I don't want to look at the minus 1, minus 2, because they're equivalent. So. basically, yeah. You could find peace with yourself with So here's the degree of degeneracy, here's the energy on this axis. And here is C60. And I have two dots here, which basically correspond to degeneracy 3. So basically I have 3 zero modes for each dot, and they show me also how much energy they have. And you see that they are near zero. They're not exactly zero, indeed, because my lattice is finite. All the studies I did shouldn't give me a zero mode because I don't have an infinite lattice, right? They give me some finite energy, indeed. But as I move forward and I look at C240, you can see that these two triplets, they come closer to zero, and C540, you have even closer to zero. So you have this tendency, the bigger your molecule, the closer these modes go to zero. So you have 6 zero modes, and it's exactly how much you get if you put g equals 0 and n equals 0 here. You get 6.
Wait, there's 2? There's only 2?
2, but there are triplets. This is a degree of degeneracy down here. So there are 2 triplets corresponding to each one. And this, the bigger your molecule, the better the continuum approximation, the better, the more this approaches the zero energy. Now let's go to the nanotube. There we have genus equals zero, and the number of faces is equal, missing is equal to 2. The endpoints. Now, I have 2 different geometrical configurations. I mean, I have many, but I'll put down 2 for nanotubes. The one so-called armchair, because it has this structure. It's not a very comfortable one. But here you have the zigzag configuration, depending how you apply the periodic conditions. Now, this is on the momentum plane. And these are your Fermi points, okay? And this is a hexagonal lattice, the hexagonal lattice in the Fermi, in the momentum components we saw earlier on with the crown configuration. And if I add the periodic condition, okay, that adds in another constraint. Because it's a finite system, I'll have the constraint superposed with my energy requirements. It gives me these lines that my system can be on. In the zero energy, my system can be only on these Fermi points. So I have to look at superpositions of them, and indeed I have these 2 points that for the armchair configuration, which give me the number of zero modes. Now, for each point here, Fermi point with plus k plus, I have always a k minus coming in, because this constraint, these lines are always symmetric with respect to this, the center on the momentum plane. So if I have a minus, a k plus, I will have always a k minus. So they come always in pairs. And as we saw, sigma z actually takes you from plus momentum to minus, or takes you from Dirac equation from one Fermi point to the other, which is a symmetry of your system, no matter what, especially if you don't have any defects like genus, like pentagons. So, and that also you can see it very simply. If you have a nanocube, as many components, zero modes, you have energy states moving that way, you should have the same number moving that way. There is no reason why the symmetry should be broken. So I have zero here, but I have all equal numbers here. That gives you zero. Also, in the zigzag configuration, this constraint is parallel lines going that don't go through your Fermi points, so you have zero number of zero modes, so you have zero here again. So these 2 cases agree well with the number of with what we expect in graphene.
I'm still confused. If I plug in G being 0 and in 2, I'm getting 12 instead of 0. 6 times absolute value of 1 minus g plus 3m.
Yes, you have a minus sign here. You're right. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, yes. Thank you. Indeed. Here is how you could simulate, in principle, this thing with optical graphene, with optical lattices and Fermi atoms. But and actually, the detection of having conductivity or not is a component that has been performed in the laboratory in Florence. But I won't go much through it because already I took too much of your time. We can discuss it later. So let me just go quickly through what we saw. So we have an index theorem that gives you the zero modes for various graphene configurations, and indeed gives you the right number for fullerenes and nanotubes. But you could, it applies also to more complex molecules, right, that people haven't made, I think, I'm not sure, they haven't made any calculations for. Also, it predicts the stability of the spectrum against small deformations, geometrical or magnetic fields. Also, topological models. Now, how that relates, I mean, now, for each, if I had this lattice, I would have that many number of zero modes, right? So that big degeneracy, if you like. One thing which is protected by topology, the genus, one thing that I'm not 100% sure is, or not sure, is that if these states, actually, these different zero modes can be distinguished locally, okay? These zero energy modes are found for graphene, actually. They have a different density profiles in electrons. So if I go and measure electron number, I will see that they are different. But is that an allowed thing to do? I mean, if I make local deformations of geometry or apply external fields, I won't change this number. I won't be able to distinguish between the zero modes. But if I add another component, another Hilbert, you know, extend the Hilbert space into the density as well, then I can distinguish between them. So I'm not 100% clear about that point. This can be also simulated with cold atom technology, and that might give maybe things that we can measure easier than we can do with graphene. I just thank you for your attention.
When saying cold atoms, you mean fermions on the lattice?
Okay, good. Let's go there. Yes, I will need fermions. Fermi atoms in an optical lattice. You can create a hexagonal configuration with three lasers shine like that, and the atoms will go and see in the combined...
Is it 2D lattice?
Yeah, I have to kind of have another perpendicular optical lattice to squeeze them in two dimensions.
So do I understand correctly that you want to simulate the graphene structure by arranging an optical lattice?
Indeed, yes, that's possible.
You know, with these lasers and optical lattices, almost everything is possible.
Yes, yes. I mean, actually, you need temperatures which are, I mean, the temperatures it can achieve is like 0.1, the Fermi temperature, which is pretty low to see such effects. Also, you can achieve arbitrary filling factors, and the half that we require here is also seems to be...
Yeah.
But you will need also binary. So you will need site A, site B, site A, site B, and so on.
No. This came completely for being able to diagonalize, as a mathematical trick ahead. So it has to be exactly like this. The atoms will sit on these triangles, which are the minimum potentials. And
why do you say 0.1 Fermi temperature? Is it the temperature that you are going to achieve?
No. This is what they can do already, which I'm saying that
that's what they can do in the gas phase, and that's what they do experimentally.
Yes.
In the lattice, maybe also.
That's true.
Well, Esslinger was here. He said that he can do.
Yes. You know, Esslinger says Immanuel Bloch calls even lower temperature, but our good friend Jason Horn, who is absent here now, has different arguments related to the temperature in those experiments. Yes. So it's a little bit questionable so far. But probably it's possible, and the filling factors are also possible. So.
But let me understand this point, because I understood that it's very important that you have this binary structure in such a way that you have two sites per unit cell. That's true.
Because you said automatically, it's the property of the lattice. It's a geometric property of the lattice.
Yes. Having a hexagonal lattice or honeycomb lattice will give you that property automatically.
But I guess cutting and getting in five-sided heptagon in there.
This is about introducing defects. What kind of properties you will see in there, that is questionable. I mean, you have to...
What about the role of boundaries? I mean, you will... you will automatically have boundaries.
I didn't say that we can simulate things that are related to the index theorem. I said we can simulate graphene. Now, for simulating things, then you have to talk about the boundaries, and you will have an index theorem on a disk, and you have it. You can still do interesting physics there as well, or mathematics.
But it's not the same as having open places.
No, it's not the same. So you will need a modification of the index theorem on a disk. Here,
But having one open face sounds like you have a disk.
Yes. Here, when I said open faces, I meant things that you could reconnect continuously.
It's again the same discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
I think on one face, he would not call open.
Yeah.
Can you just put a blue GT laser in the center, like a hole? Isn't that enough to see something interesting?
Yes, definitely. I think some interesting physics that you could probe is, for example, putting defects. And defects like the pentagons, they have long range effect. I mean, you have one pentagon in the middle, and that has topological effects which go all around your system. The holes and things like that, they have also similar, very interesting physics that I think...
the hole wouldn't destroy the bipartiteness, therefore you wouldn't get this monopole physics.
So if you have a number of holes, then you have this high-dimensional space of zero modes, right? Because it's proportional to the Euler characteristic.
Right. You mean if I have a G... higher G, or a flat surface.
Say you fix G to the zero, just to even the line experiment, and you have 100 holes. Okay,
right.
That were made by blue detuned lasers or whatever. This gives you a high dimensional space of zero modes, correct?
Yes, we would need a different version of the index theorem, that the one I discussed here, but I think that would be very interesting. I think that's the possibility how it will come out.
What I'm wondering is, but the number of modes, zero modes, is not that large. It's linear in the number of holes. Is that right? Because it's a multiple.
The modes, yes. The states will go 2 to that power.
Oh, 2 to the power. It goes
the states will go exponentially.
Oh, okay. So if the states go exponentially, it's natural to ask what the brain group representation would be. That is, as you move the holes around each other, you have some action of the brain group on the zero modes, and I'm wondering, is this the Fockian representation?
That's actually a very interesting point that let me restate a little bit. What happens if you take two pentagons and you move them around? These pentagons, they have a certain flux going through, and they might be natural candidates for anions, right? And I don't know the answer, to be honest. I'm looking at it. But it's a very interesting thing to see what's the statistics of these objects.
But the spectrum is gapless.
No, you have a degeneracy, and you have a gap above it, but at least for the examples I looked at.
Guarantee that you can move these things adiabatically, but if you have a continuous spectrum, is it that the notion of adiabaticity still holds?
You have to find a gapped system and do that.
But in graphene, at least if you don't have holes, there's no gap, right? Because there are points.
Yeah, if it's flat.
So once you insert these holes, you generate.
Well, I mean, you can put the whole thing on the torus. I mean, you create then a gap, gap system. I mean, it's a finite size gap. Yeah. Well, but still, you have the effective gauge theory appearing, and so you.
And secondly, if you have a hole, is the zero mode localized around that hole?
And also, you might create different types of excitations, but you won't create different pentagons or hexagons. So the statistics and the topology will be protected. Right? Yeah. Please. So,
if you have a hole, is the zero mode localized on this hole or more like spread all over? And if you find the wave function of the zero
mode. Right. Yeah. These are zero modes which are states of the whole system. So it's not electronic states of your pentagon only. It's not the state of the pentagon inside. It's the state of your whole system. So whatever things you do, you have to do really slowly so that the whole system understands or feels the changes.
So that means that probably this anioic analogy might not work.
Because yeah.
On top of it is a Dirac fermion, it's not Majorana fermion, so they're not delocalized in the sense of how Kitaev emphasized. As far as applications to,
I can speculate about these things. As I said, I haven't looked at it in depth.
Maybe to clarify. So effective gauge fields that arise. These are all abelian in your context. Is that correct?
Abelian.
Abelian gauge fields.
If I can diagonalize it and get an abelian equation,
so no SU2 gauge fields here.
No SU2 gauge fields.
Okay, then what I don't understand is how does your dimension counting work? Why do you get an exponential number 2 to the number of holes? It seemed to me that the index theorem, the Euler characteristic chi, entered linearly into the formula.
Indeed, yes.
So, but a moment ago you said there was an exponentially large degeneracy.
Indeed, yes.
He's talking about occupying or emptying the zero mode states.
So it's zero mode. Yeah. The number of zero modes go linearly, but its mode can be occupied or empty. It's
so one particle states. You're calculating one particle states.
Yes, indeed. Yes. The states will go exponentially, the modes go linearly. Mm-hmm. The zero modes are Majorana. I mean, you could. That's a little question. We can.
The
zero modes. Well, I mean, also in the example we saw yesterday, you had the real Dirac fermions, actual Dirac fermions, but the zero modes became Majorana because you had they were Hermitian.
So the whole point is that yesterday's example was different from today's example. In fact, in yesterday's example, this index theorem doesn't work.
Sure, I agree completely. Yeah, this is completely different. You have to.
The manifestation there is that the zero modes are Majorana, and I think zero modes here is Dirac.
Well, okay, I guess the way to cap, we could tell it by just seeing how many there are. That is, are the zero modes created by a pair of defects or a single defect? Because if they're shared
indeed,
by a pair
yes.
of defects, they're probably Majorana. But which is it?
But here, if you...
A single pentagon gives a zero mode, or two of them do? This is the key question.
Yes, so... for example, if you have a flat sheet and you want to introduce a pentagon, then this will be always paired by a heptagon. So you can introduce only if the background is flat. So if you assume that you don't have any dynamics on the boundaries, they will come always in pairs. So.
Yeah, but your soccer ball example, you had 6 0 modes, right?
In the C60. Right, yes, yes.
So that sounds like it takes 2 pentagons to make a zero mode. Because there are 12 pentagons in the soccer ball and you got 6 0 modes. So it sounds like there might be something in Majorana.
Indeed, yes. The counting is like that. Yeah.
If they're Majorana, then your formula of 2 to the number of zero modes wouldn't work. Because that works only for Dirac. You're saying each zero mode can be populated or emptied.
No, it's not the right formula. It's just a question of.
Relating what is zero mode.
Yeah,
he's counted Dirac zero mode somehow because he took 2 to the power of a number of these modes. But yes, if that zero mode is somehow shared between several defects. But I think, sorry, in this example, because I haven't thought about it clearly, but I think I know enough to be fairly certain of how it works here. Actually, I wanted to ask a question.
Please.
Could you comment on how the presence of the zero modes would affect the conductivity of the graphene issue?
This is an issue that experts on graphene can answer better. So if you have, you see, the point is that if you have zero modes, then you could populate these states easily with a small potential change of your potential difference. If you don't have zero modes and your next states are far away from the zero energy, then you need to apply a strong potential in order to come all the way up and populate them. If you populate them, then you could have certain conductivity moving electrons there. Of course, there are certain issues, like if you have a conical point, then you're not only interested about if you have states, but also the density of states, because you have zero density if you're on the conical point, and if you're near there, you know, start increasing. So you have to integrate with the density of states as well. So this is an issue that I skillfully try to avoid, or probably not, in my talk.
Do you know what the sort of likelihood of the on-ground of elasticity of getting actual pentagon-hexagon pairs?
This is also another interesting thing. It gives you additional effects that also I didn't want to. I wanted a pure theoretical system here. If you go more towards the physical system, you have to include more effects in, indeed.
Do you know if it's likely or not that you get these
pentagons and so on?
Yeah,
or?
Very likely.
I mean,
there's mathematical constraints. For example, in one of these sticky tape experiments, it's impossible to have one pentagon and one silicon.
Yeah.
Oh, did you know that?
Well, this is like water season.
No. It's an additional constraint.
So you think it's impossible to have?
It's impossible to have one 5-bond and one 7-bond.
Oh,
you can have 2 5-bonds and 2 7-bonds, but you can't have one of each.
Oh, right.
Yes, indeed.
Why is that?
It's a very nice. Fantastic.
Yeah, no, this is purely. So if you, for instance, if you take a honeycomb lattice and you do a single F move to an edge, so in other words, you take an edge and you shift it to a point and let it pop out the other direction. What you'll see is a pair of hexagons, a pair of 5-bonds, and a pair of 7-bonds. And in fact, this is the element of the defect. You can't have one of each. And the proof that you can't have one of each, the simplest proof I know involves the idea of the developing map. That is, you think of a defect, a 5-bond defect, as a clockwise rotation of 60 degrees, and a 7-bond defect under development is a counterclockwise defect. And the point is that if you rotate it to the plane from two different sites, clockwise and counterclockwise, 60 degrees, that's not those are not inverse to each other. The composition gives a translation. And it's this translation, the non-triviality of this translation, that shows that it's impossible to have these defects preserving the honeycomb structure near the thing.
Or you can take a hexagonal lattice and try to create pentagons and heptagons. You see, they'll come in pairs.
They come in quadruples.
Yes, two pentagons with two heptagons. So you have a pentagon here and a pentagon, here. And then the rest will be heptagons.
That's proof that you can never end up with them. I mean, because
that's true. Yes, yes. Yes, yeah, indeed. That's poor man's proof.
But can you decompile them? Like, can you create a quadrupole?
Yeah.
Move them away, yes.
Around. They can run all around once they're decompiled.
I think it's a very interesting gate theory. Now, if it's topological or not, that's a different question. I'm not. You can look at it. I think it's very interesting.
So you can take all four defects?
Yeah, they can all run around.
Yes. And then you would like to see what happens if you move one around the other, if you get anything interesting. Well, you have the sense of string also there. You have also with onions. is where your cut happened. So yeah, I think it's an interesting model.
Given the finite size spectrum, do you know anything about the scaling of how these finite size spectrum and scale, and how the splittings would scale with system size?
No, I can't comment on that.
But you have the data, right?
But it definitely, yes, we have the data, numerics, but also any mixing will create fermionic excitations, not anionic. So you shouldn't worry about the statistical properties of your excitations; they will stay the same. So.
Oh, I wasn't worried about.
Right. Yes. So there is a postdoc position also that Lisa would like to advertise. Favorably, people from Quadu Hall effect background are very welcome to apply. Thank you.